Transmission commence in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Level 7.
RandomChatter.com presents
the Strategic Homeland Intervention Enforcement and Logistics Division.
Do you copy?
Perimeter Breach.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
Authorizing.
Just call us S.H.I.E.L.D.
Access granted.
Colson, get back to base.
Welcome back, agents. I trust you have all been suitably briefed on the most recent encounter. We'll be your hosts on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files. I'm Director Shepard.
And I'm Director Stolze.
And you have all been authorized to undergo debriefing on the most recent mission from Agent Coulson and his operatives presented to the public as a dramatic hour-long television series known as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Even though technically they're kind of agents of Proto-S.H.I.E.L.D. now, I guess. It's not...
Proto-S.H.I.E.L.D. Now we got to think of what... Proto stands for
P-R-O-T-O. We'll come up with something, I think, before the end of the episode. Fortunately, okay. Though, you've all been cleared to know the truth. So we've got another exciting case files for everyone tonight. And you know what? Let's just get right into it, Josh. I don't think there's any reason to delay the inevitable here.
Yeah, hold on. Sorry. I got to hold up my head.
Keeps hitting the hit. So why are you trying to hold your head up?
I'm sorry. I got my head is a bit heavy. I apologize, but I got some duct tape. I'll just tape onto my shoulders here. That's all good.
Duct tape.
It is. It's Fitz made it for me.
Oh, good. Well, then I'm sure it will be top. What is it? Top. There's some other word there that goes with top.
The notch.
That's it. Yes. Top notch.
Dog.
Top
hat, hat, top hat. That's what it is.
TC, of course it is.
okay, so, all right, anyway, so this is episode 2 of the season. Heavy is the Head. Sounds like a heavy metal rock band album. I don't know.
When I first heard the title, I was like, that's an interesting title. And then as it started percolating through my brain, I had some other, maybe they mean this, and we're going to actually get into that here, so... Let's find out the particulars about this episode.
All right, Heavy is the Head aired on September 30th, 2014, and it was written by our old friend Paul Bzuski.
Yes.
And now you'll probably recognize that name from season 1. He actually wrote 4 episodes in season 1, including some of the ones toward the end, Nothing Personal and End of the Beginning. 2 actually really good episodes I remember talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Those were the ones where they really started getting good.
Yeah.
So I think he'd also written which was a good Fitz and Simmons episode as well.
Right. That was early in the season.
Yeah, that was like 4th or 5th, I think.
Right. Well, it was directed by Jesse Bochco. And you might recognize that name as Stephen Bochco. He's the son of Stephen Bochco. and he directed Girl in the Flower Dress from season 1.
Another interesting tie-in here with the because that was first appearance of Raina.
Yes, and that was a very interesting character that continues to come back to the story.
And continues to be interesting.
Continues to be interesting. Yes, I agree with that too. So, all right. Well, let me break down this episode for us real quick here. As May continues the pursuit of Carl Creel from the last episode, you know, aka the Absorbing Man, Lance Hunter, who was in that car crash with Hartley, was Hunter driving?
No,
was
that right? Idaho was driving.
Oh, Idaho was driving.
Hunter
that's
was
right.
in the
okay,
back so. Cutting her arm off, Hartley's arm off.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he was busy. Yeah, and you should never text and drive, and you should never cut someone's arm off and drive.
It's
very dangerous, yes, for sure. Anyway, so he's captured by General Talbot, or at least General Talbot's men. And Talbot wants him to deliver Coulson to him. But Coulson uses his heavy head to pull the remains of the team back to regroup for a new plan to get Creel and the Obelisk. Creel, though, he's got some problems of his own. Despite his rubbery precautions, that Obelisk is taking over his body and making it really hard to tip your waitstaff.
Yeah.
he wants Hydra to help him stop it. But there might be someone else that can help him. We'll talk about who that might be. That someone may be wearing a flowered dress.
Hmm.
So, but the new S.H.I.E.L.D., or I'm sorry, Proto Shield has to decide if they can trust Hunter to keep their location a secret. Unless, of course, you know, Fitz and his new friend Mac can work out the cloaking technology to hide the bus, which is not a new Apple product, by the way. Mac is the name of the mechanic that we met last episode.
Right. Now, I want to do a joke about mac and cheese later, but that would then require me to give everybody the backstory on Coulson's appearance originally in Marvel Comics, where he was just known as Cheese. He was the friend of another SHIELD of an operative known as it was the guy that would eventually go on to become Nick Fury in the Black Nick Fury that we see in the movies. And his white friend was, he just called him Cheese, and that's a weird nickname. But at the end, you realize it's Coulson. So, that's a long explanation, so I don't want to get into that. But we can now have Mac and Cheese on the show.
That's so excellent. I would have written that character in just for that.
Yeah.
Even if only four people knew the joke. But now, we've spread it. Now lots of people know.
I'll get the full details. I'll put that on one of our other shows here, or I'll add it to our Facebook page so that people can read the story themselves. But before we get into discussing this this really interesting episode, I just want to give some news here. We are continuing to give news on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well as Agent Carter. And as probably surprising nobody in our listening audience, if you are fans of this franchise, Dominic Cooper will be returning as Howard Stark to the Agent Carter show. So that's great. Obviously, he was very instrumental in the short, the Agent Carter short, as well as in Captain America: The First Avenger, where we were first introduced to Agent Carter.
Yeah, maybe it's not a surprise, but either way, I think it's good news that so many of the original actors are coming back for this series, because it's a really nice connection to the universe as a whole with the Captain America movie.
Mm-hmm. And as someone posted on a I can't remember if it was on our Facebook page or if I saw it in a comment of another story I was reading. They said basically, if Neil McDonough gets confirmed as being on the Agent Carter series, and that's Dum Dum Dugan, it's just going to be that's the only thing that can make it better right now, I think. And I agree.
I agree too. Love Dum Dum.
Good. I was really pleased to see him in the season premiere of S.H.I.E.L.D. last week. So I'm sure, even if he's not going to be a regular, I'm sure he will show up in some fashion, as like support on the Agent Carter show. That's
good.
That's my thought.
Not enough bowler hats on TV these days.
That is true. That is true. He really does. He's bringing the bowler back. And then we talked about the possibilities of this last week, and I think this really caught you as a surprise, but basically Agent Xena, Agent Hartley, is actually dead.
Yeah, apparently. It did surprise me, and that's been confirmed.
Well, I mean, they buried her this week.
Yes, yeah. Well, it was confirmed even before this episode, but I mean, you know how that works. I mean, you can I think Coulson was buried too, wasn't he?
Nick Fury's been buried. Well, at least he has a grave.
Yeah. But where didn't Agent May get information from Coulson's grave last season, or was that from Nick Fury's grave?
No, I think you're right. I think it was Coulson's grave.
Yeah. See, so just because someone's buried, come on now.
Well,
that doesn't mean anything.
Izzy,
but
we hardly knew you.
That did surprise me, just because it was such a well-known actor, and they really made kind of a big stink about her being on the show, which rightly so. I thought she did a good job.
Yeah, but like we discussed last week, it's that psycho connection. You know, it's the fake out of, hey, put a big star on the show, and it's like they aren't going to kill that person because they're a big star. Well,
yeah,
nobody is safe. Joss Whedon's universe, nobody is safe.
That is true. Now, real quick though, I don't have a problem with him killing her off, because it does make it very interesting. But I would have, I maybe like to keep her around for a few episodes to make her a really, well liked character, and a more established character, so you really get closer feelings for her. Because it seems as if maybe she had a pretty personal connection with Coulson in the past.
She had a connection with Coulson, and she had a connection with Hunter.
Yeah, but she didn't have that. Yeah, very much so with Hunter. But but she didn't have that connection with the audience, you know. So it would have been nice to get a little a little more backstory on her before they killed her off. Then it would have meant a little bit more.
Well, I don't think that, again, her death precludes us getting that backstory. If you think back to Arrow, another show that we do a podcast on, there's been a character that's been dead. He was dead at the end of season one, and we still got a lot more of him as a character, you know, with appearances and stuff throughout season two, and he's supposedly going to be in season three as well. So, you know, just, I mean, even if she really is dead and they are not going to bring her back in the, you know, in the future moments of the show, that doesn't preclude her showing up in flashbacks or anything. Not that they've done a lot of flashbacks on this show. So far, I think really, if I come to think about it, the 1945 flashback last week may have been the only one we've seen.
Well, oh, they did some stuff with Ward's childhood.
That's right. We did Ward recounting how he met Garrett too. Okay, so they do. Oh, do some flashbacks. So.
So there you go. Okay, so that's a possibility. So I'd like to see her back. I thought it was an interesting character and a good actor playing her. But we do have a nice little load of new characters to talk about so far this season. It's only been two episodes. So.
Yep. And we've got another new actor who's been cast, Tim DeKay, who people may know from the USA show White Collar, has been hired on as a new character. Not going to get into any descriptions because I feel that I would like to save that for the episode where he shows up. I got to say, I mean, if you look online, you can find out a little bit more about who he's playing. Know that it is, knowing the character's name, know that it is a spoiler alert. I don't know about you, Josh. It blindsided me, and I was like, well, I would have liked to have the choice to know or not know about spoilers, and I usually want to know, but I want that choice.
I'm trying my best to respect people's opinions on that spoiler. For me, it was a nice shock, and it made me look forward to what's coming. Mm-hmm. But I've learned recently that my particular personal policy of spoilers is not a widely held policy by people.
No, see, for me, I mean, again, I just kind of like to know because I find it distracting when I'm finding out new information. My brain tries to process it while I'm watching it. And then, I'm going to have to watch it again anyway. So I'd kind of rather know this stuff so I can kind of be prepared for it and let the show do its twists and turns to me, but without the distraction of me going, oh, my God, that's so-and-so. And then as I'm thinking about all the connections, all of a sudden I missed, you know, what's going on. But I'd also rather us just be discussing stuff on the show without having known that something is happening or coming up or a character is coming or something like that. So our discussions are honest and, you know, actually speculative, and we may or may not be hitting on the right information as we discuss it with each other on our podcast here. So,
true.
You know, that's kind of how I look about it. But anyway, true. You've been warned. If you guys want to go out and look on the internet, I don't know I don't think we posted the link on Facebook. If we do,
I did post the link, but I didn't say who the character was in my comments.
Okay.
So if you want to click it, you can find out who it is.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into talking about the episode Heavy. Heavy is the Head, which, as I said to you earlier, really weird name for an episode. And only as I kind of ruminated on it a little bit did I realize, it's part of a quote. And I don't know if you'd ever heard this one before, but there's a quote that goes, "Heavy is the head that wears the crown." Were you familiar with that quote?
Yeah, that's a very famous quote.
Yeah, it's one of those quotes like "Play It Again, Sam." That's not actually a quote. You know, it's a misquote. It actually is from.
Is that from a Shakespeare play too?
Say that again.
Is that from a Shakespeare play too? Play It Again, Sam.
Play It Again, Sam is from. I believe it was from A Midsummer Night's Dream. But
oh, okay.
I'm not sure.
Right.
Anyway, this is the misguide. It's actually from Casablanca, just in case anyone out there doesn't know that. But the heavy is the head that wears the crown. It's a misquoted line from Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 2. And I love that you put in the date here, 1597, as if, you know, we would be confusing it with the other Henry IV, Part 2. That
well, I didn't want anybody to not, you know, know that we were giving them credit. You know, I didn't want... I didn't want Bill Shakespeare to come back and say, hey, you know, come on.
Come on, guys. I can't believe you misquoted me. No, wait, that's Bill Shatner, isn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, a little Bill Shatner, a little Doc Brown there, I think, too.
Yeah. Anyway, the original line is actually, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. So, but, you know, again, I started thinking about this, and it's like, okay, well, that's a little bit better title than we've had before, such as The Girl in the Flower Dress, which, amazingly, in the episode had a girl in a flower dress. This allows us a little more leeway to kind of discuss the title. What are your thoughts about what they're trying to say to us with using this title, knowing that that is the quote that it comes from?
So as far as like what do I think it means or
yeah what do you like
yeah for, well
why do they do that
you know this heavy is the head that wears the crown or you know or the original one it's talking about somebody with a lot of responsibility, somebody maybe with some power that has a lot of things on their mind, a lot of things to worry about, and you know in this case we have maybe a few different people who are in charge that have a lot of responsibilities right now. But for me, the person that it really just pointed a main finger at was Coulson.
Oh, obviously. Yeah. I think that's a really good point. He has a lot on his plate. We discussed a little bit about this last week. We could see, you know, that he was busy. He's running around. He's in charge of all these people. We find out this week that, you know, some of the other things that he's been doing to get S.H.I.E.L.D. back up and running, such as he's eliminated levels from the organization. So, you know, there's no level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But he still is, and they talk about this, that he is compartmentalizing everything. And I think the hardest thing about that is, you know, you got to remember who you've told what to. Like, or who you are allowed to talk to. Obviously, he's keeping secrets from the majority of the team. He trusts May, but, you know, he still has to act as her superior. I mean, it's not easy for him. He's working hard here.
Definitely working hard. I mean, that would be a big responsibility no matter what. But in addition to that, he has other things to worry about that May is helping him with.
Yeah, lots of like personal problems dealing with the, well, I'm assuming it's from the what was it, the GH325 that he got injected with last season that saved his life. All the, you know, the what do they call them, episodes?
That's what he called them, his episodes.
Called them his episodes where he has to carve the symbols into the wall and everything like that.
Yeah.
So
in addition to all of the other rebuilding S.H.I.E.L.D. issues he has, apparently cost cutting isn't necessarily one of his responsibilities because everything is still moving electronically, embedded in desks, a lot of holograms. Either that or he's getting, you know, a discount from Stark Industries or something. I don't
Was that your first idea when you saw the contents from the cube, the way he had the Minority Report screens up, that it was Stark technology?
Well, yes, actually, that was my first thought. And also my first thought was, wait, aren't they on the run? Aren't they trying to save money?
Yeah.
But maybe that was all installed before.
Well,
maybe that's all funded by Hydra.
Possibly. I mean, it appears that they're in an old SSR bunker building of some kind, right? I mean, it's someplace that is big enough that it's got a hangar that holds the bus and a Quinjet. It's got the SSR logos on the wall, and, you know, it appears to have some old kind of hardware. But then, like you said, there's this desk with the little cube that Fury gave him. I forget what he called that. He had a special name for the cube, like playbook or something like that, I think. And, you know, so there's this high-tech stuff mixed with this kind of old, you know, World War II era furniture and buildings and stuff like that, which is really interesting.
And don't forget the newly tiled bathroom.
Oh, yes, they did just retail the bathroom. And they still have their George Foreman grill, which is
that's right.
Which is good to know. That thing is.
There were some amazing quotes in this episode from Coulson.
This was fun. Yeah, there was some funny stuff going on. And Clark Gregg delivered it in that real dry way that he did. And I almost some of his quotes, while they're, you know, he's trying to be funny, I like the way that Clark delivered them, because he kind of, I mean, he made me feel a little sad for him. The one I'm thinking of right now, you know, because they can all be kind of taken in different ways, is Skye's come in and talk to him, and she's like, you know, you got to just chill out. You should try yoga or something. And basically she's leaving, and he's saying, I've tried yoga. I'm just not that flexible. But she's like already gone. I mean, he's like saying it more kind of to himself and in a very sort of, you know, dry, you know, self-deprecating way. Like
it was very Coulson-like, which Coulson-like needs to be added to our SHIELD vocabulary. I think that can, so it's an official word.
Okay.
Right? but also, yeah, I agree with you. He seemed kind of sad because he's clearly trying to take care of himself and yet take care of SHIELD at the same time. And taking care of SHIELD means taking care of the people that are close to him, which includes Skye and May and Fitz, possibly Ward as well, actually.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot talked about him this episode. I feel that was a – after what we saw last week, I would have liked to have continued on with that a little bit, and I'm sure we will. It's just there's so many characters. They can only do so much per, you know, per episode.
But, well, and I kind of feel like if they'd put Ward in this one, it would have been forced because he wasn't needed in this episode.
Exactly. Because this episode really was a continuation of last week's episode, and he'd already given them the information that they need. And like you said, yeah, there's really no reason to go back to him for any reason. So, yeah, and Coulson still does have that kind of paternal instinct that he's, you know, trying to take care of everybody. But obviously he's got larger issues, and he's having to make some tough decisions. I think, you know, I felt that he seemed to be giving May some more latitude, but then he had to order her to stop her pursuit. Like, you know, she was just going to basically ignore him and, you know, get what she thought the job was to be done. But he had to remind her, it's like, you know what? I'm the boss. This is an order. And that's, as soon as he said order, you know, she stood down then, and she wasn't happy about it. And obviously with all the things that she's understanding that he's going through, you know, I think that just adds the, you know, burden onto everything. So
it sort of makes his head heavy.
It does make his head heavy. And also just so from a personal standpoint, you know, I don't know that we can assume, you know, we know what's going on with him, because, you know, they haven't really given us enough information here. But just imagine if he's calling them episodes, right? So that's something that happens every about 2.5 weeks, because they said it's been either 17 or 18 days, and he's due or overdue for another one of these episodes. And it's obviously taking something of himself to hold these episodes in. He's folding bending paper clips into weird shapes as kind of an outlet, but obviously there's some kind of compulsion or something going on within him that's forcing him, you know, subconsciously, I guess, to just kind of regurgitate this drawing, which appears to, you know, be the same image every time he does it. I mean, it's really hard to tell, but
it reminds me, and I don't know if this is a good comparison or not. It just kind of struck me, but what he's doing with the symbols and the paperclip, especially that's what kind of made me think of this. Is it reminds me of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Richard Dreyfuss,
yes,
was he had something inside of him
that compulsion.
He was trying to get out, but he didn't know what it was.
Yeah. That's really interesting. You know what? The thing that it reminded me of, and I think this may just be because we've got Kyle MacLachlan on it, there's a quote from Dune It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. It's by the juice of Sappho that thoughts acquire speed, the lips acquire stains, stains become a warning. It is by my will alone I set my mind in motion.
I think that was pretty good. I think you need to say it a little bit faster, though. You know, it is by my will alone I set my mind in motion.
But I mean, that's kind of the same thing. At least the way that I remember it from the movie, it's this, you know, these people are taking this medicine that kind of gives them this compulsion to be able to turn themselves into these human computers. And that's kind of what Coulson has. It's I don't even know, you know, it's hard to tell what's happening with him because they go to a montage style when they are showing him carving the symbols into the wall. But it's like a fugue state where, you know, I don't know that he's consciously aware of what's happening. It's kind of like he just surrenders and whatever is, you know, connecting with him or controlling him, you know, kind of just goes to town.
So he is clearly aware that he's doing it, but you're saying that he doesn't maybe he doesn't know as he's doing it, he doesn't know what he's doing.
Right.
He's not aware at the time that he's carving them, you think?
Right. There's a medical term, which I just used, the fugue state, which is where people actually enter sort of a trance and can do repetitive tasks, but it's like they're asleep or sleepwalking in some fashion. Basically, the mind disconnects the conscious part from the subconscious part or something like that.
That's interesting because that hadn't occurred to me that maybe he wasn't aware of it at the time. To me, it was just like he knew, you know, he was watching himself doing it. He just felt like he had to do it, but he wasn't really thinking about what it was. Maybe that's the same thing, I guess, now that you say that.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it seemed like at the end of the beginning of the end, which is the season finale, where he was carving them, he seemed really surprised by having the completed design in front of him. You know, and again, we had that same sort of, you know, we get this very, what I want to say, this relaxing sort of music that's going along with it. You know, it's kind of trance-like, I guess. Not like trance music, but just relaxation music and stuff like that. And then, you know, he comes out of it, and it's just like, oh, wow, look what I did. You know, that's kind of what it seemed to me. And the fact that he's having May take pictures throughout the process means that, you know, I mean, why take pictures throughout the process if you can just take a picture at the end? You know, he wants to record the process of putting it up there because, obviously, I think he just doesn't know what's going on.
I was going to say last night, but not everybody saw it last night. This episode, when he it almost seemed like they were kind of setting him up to do it, and he was able to not control doing it, because it was clear that it was really bursting forth, trying to keep it back until he was ready to let it loose. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me like he was able to start when he wanted to start. You know, he got the knife out on his own. He was ready. He told May to film and all that. So,
yeah. Well, he's been keeping it in check.
I can kind of see that now, that as he's doing it, he probably kind of blanks out.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably pretty boring just drawing all these circles and lines and stuff. But yeah, I mean, he was able to, if he was able to keep it in check as long as he had, I mean, obviously if it's, you know, I don't want to get, you know, gross, so I'll go this way. You know, like if you have to burp, like you can hold it in, you know, for a little bit, but like when you got to burp, you got to get it out. Right. You know, so.
Sure. And if you don't, it becomes, well, painful, you know, it's very uncomfortable, and that's probably what this is.
So you had an interesting
one thought I had about,
I was going to bring this up.
This is just why does he have to carve it? What's the carving part of it? Why not just draw it or, you know, make it out of mashed potatoes or, you know, whatever he needs to do to see it. And I think he does have to carve it too, because remember, Bill Paxton's character did the same thing,
mm-hmm. Right?
Didn't he grab like a nail or something and start carving it into?
Yeah, it was a nail or a bolt or something like that that he pulled out. I don't know. I mean, there's something, I want to say tribal, about the fact that it's being carved. I mean, it's much more visceral than drawing, right? I mean, it's a much more, there's more, it's more of an act to be carving something than just drawing it, right? You're actually, you know, etching it. You're, you know, you're making indentations in something else. And, you know, it seems, like I said, just kind of tribal, like, you know, the...
Like the sand drawings.
Like sand drawings, you know what I mean? Or like, you know, carving a totem pole or something else. Like, you know, just it seems to be just another level up of in terms of physicality. And maybe it's just from a storytelling standpoint, maybe it's more interesting to have it carved, but there may be some other reason to it.
Maybe. Well, and there might be ultimately whatever it ends up being for, it might have some tactile purpose, you know.
Well,
that you have to either feel or something follows along the lines of it or something.
Interesting that you bring up tactile. So when when May mentioned to Coulson about the obelisk, which by the way looks like a 1990s cell phone, like just one of those big box phones. I keep wanting, because there's a round button right there. I want them to pick it up.
About as well too.
I want them to push the button and pick it. Hello. And it's Orson. It's for you.
You have to shout. You'll have to pull the antenna up and shout, though, when you do that.
But she said when Hartley touched it, the same symbols, or maybe it was Skye that said this, but the same symbols that she had been investigating for Coulson showed up almost as if they were in Braille. So maybe there, maybe it's some sort, you know, besides the fact that we don't know what the symbols are. Is it a map? Is it a circuit? Is it, you know, some language or something like that? But the fact that he's carving, right? So he's making indentations into things, whereas the obelisk has a bump, you know, it actually protrudes. You know, it almost seems like a puzzle, right? You've got the negative and the positive image for some reason. I don't know if that has something to do with it or not.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that either. So, and I'm also wondering what he does with these walls that he's carving. Because he covers them up, right?
Yeah, because this, like, didn't he open some blinds or drape or
like
something to do this carving? Maybe they've got something that they just, like you said, like they replace behind there that he can.
So it's just like the water tank guy when he delivers the, you know, the water tanks to S.H.I.E.L.D., he just brings like a new wall for Coulson to carve into.
We got 32 bottles of water and a new wall. That'll be $7.50. Put it on my tab. You know, I don't know. It's odd. And with all the other stuff I thought about, Close Encounters had not occurred to me, but you saying that, I mean, that connects the dots so much more. I mean, it still brings up a lot of questions, but, you know, we're assuming that this has something to do with the alien blood, the blue alien in the incubator, and, you know, whatever else is going on with these characters and their abilities. Reyna obviously has something weird going on, and, you know, we don't know really what's up with Skye, just in terms of her lineage and everything like that. And, you know, Close Encounters was about, you know, having a meeting with aliens, you know, so...
I wonder if when Coulson was first brought back to life, if half of his face was like sunburn.
Yeah, that would be... You know, I mean, it's... The writers and the producers are literary enough. I can't believe that's not a coincidence, and I'm just kind of shocked I didn't realize it before now. So thank you for bringing that up. I think that was great. Well, since we've talked about it a little bit, why don't we talk a little bit more about the obelisk? If it's not a telephone, what is it?
Maybe it is a telephone.
Why is it? I mean, it could be. It could be some kind of communications device.
It could. And what we found out was that it won't kill everybody it touches. And somebody knew that would happen. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. But first of all, I want to mention about how it I don't know, would you say poisoned Creel? Was that the right word for it? I mean, I guess it's not really poisoning.
That's an interesting way to look at it. Kind of like a mercury poisoning. I mean, it was something that was slowly working its way through his system. It was basically, I think, it might have been doing what it was doing to the waitress, but slower.
Now, do you think that that was a choice of the obelisk, or do you think that was just because Creel was so strong?
I felt that it was due to Creel's abilities to be able to absorb the properties of things that it was trying to, let's say, infect him. So let's say that what happened to Hartley and what happened to the waitress is some kind of infection, right? Whether it's, you know, the cells burning themselves out from the inside out, or, you know, some kind of cancer or ashing or turning them to stone or whatever it is. But let's say it's some kind of infection. It moved a lot slower in him, and I felt it was due to the fact that, you know, he has these special abilities that allow him to, you know, control the cells in his body kind of in the same way that like a gecko or a lizard does, you know, and where it can change the color of its pigment. But obviously he can take on the abilities or the structure of whatever.
That was my thought too.
Yeah.
Because he can kind of control how his, I don't know, cells change shape. So since he could control that, he was kind of able to push it away.
Right. Cause he could control like just one arm being something or his whole body being something or whatever.
Right. I don't know what this obelisk is, but it seems to me as if it's going to turn out to be some sort of connection to the aliens, which do we still think are Kree? That's sort of the general consensus.
That seems to be the
so far.
Yeah, the current theory about it. There's really not too many other types of aliens it could be if we're talking about blue-skinned aliens, though they're, of course, welcome to change it to whatever they want. But, that's sort of the prevailing theory online.
So, and I got to wondering, because of when we first saw this in the first episode and Hydra had it, back in the 40s, and I'm wondering if maybe it could have possibly been intended for a weapon of some kind. Mm-hmm. And not just, you know, I mean, you know, there's a possibility that it wasn't intended for a weapon, but the, you know, Hydra was going to use it for that. But maybe that's what the original purpose was to begin with.
Possibly, yeah. If it's, you know, it could be one, you know, kind of some intelligent weapon, because as you mentioned, it was able, not everybody that touches it, as we've seen, succumbs to it. And the Kyle MacLachlan's character, who's credited as the Doctor in this episode, he's what?
Time traveling in his phone booth? Is that not that Doctor?
Well, I mean, he seemed to know or intuit that that it wouldn't hurt Raina. So, you know, it could be, like I said, some kind of smart weapon where it's able to, you know something about the individual or respond to something in the individual, you know, whether it's physical or mental or something.
Yeah, and so it's – I wouldn't guess that the actual obelisk has intelligence, but maybe it's some type of computer-type device, you know, that has processing capabilities, you know. So an artificial intelligence.
Any suitably advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic. So there you go. I'll just leave that here.
But and I have some see these connections, these thoughts. Should I bring them up now?
Yeah,
that have
just
to do with the Doctor and the obelisk.
Yeah, let's go. I mean, I like this. I mean, we're kind of moving through the stuff we want to talk about in a very, you know.
Okay. So I want to talk about the Doctor first. Now, are we gonna say who we think he is?
So
break this down, because I want to make this connection with him.
Okay, so I think he's Kyle MacLachlan, because that's how he was credited in the episode. No,
okay.
But he mentions the last thing that he mentions is that he wants to see his daughter. We had Ward saying last week that, hey, I've got some interesting stuff to tell you about your dad. So I think a prevailing theory, and I think a really good guess, is that this is Skye's dad. I think we can also intuit that because Raina went to meet somebody at the end of season one with a picture of Sky and said, you know, I have some information about your daughter. So that was basically, you know, we knew she had left Hydra. She mentions that in this episode. And so now she's running with this, you know, Agent Cooper here. So.
Now, so given that evidence, I'm going to say that, you know, we had the responsibility to make the claim that he's the father of Sky. And that should not be considered a spoiler because they left us a little trail of breadcrumbs to determine or at least to conclude that, right?
Okay, right.
Okay. So, do you agree?
I agree, yeah.
I think that's fair. That's not a spoiler. Hey, plus, we could be wrong.
So, I was going to say, if people are going to complain about that being a spoiler, Josh, then you know, you may just have to you know, not be on the next episode or something. We'll put you in timeout.
Yeah, all right. I understand. So, put me in that little force field wall with Ward. But, okay, so here's my thoughts of this. There's lots of different connecting thoughts. Now, it seemed to me as if the doctor had some sort of experience with this obelisk in the past.
Okay.
I maybe just researching it. I don't know. Maybe Hydra had you know, research papers or something that he's gone over, or S.H.I.E.L.D. had them, or I don't know. Or did he have actual personal experience with it? Because supposedly this thing has been locked up since, what,
1945.
Yep. Okay. So and he's not that old. He's not old enough to have had experience with it before that.
You would think so, right? But isn't the Nazi – like, he didn't seem to age between 1945 and 2014.
Oh, see, I hadn't even put that little piece of the puzzle.
And he had been exposed to the obelisk. Now, he didn't touch it. And I'm not saying that, you know, exposure to the obelisk without touching it does anything else either, but
But he seemed to know. He seemed to know how it would react to Raina.
He does, and he seems
either that or he was doing that thing like you know, where you don't want to touch something, so you grab someone else's hand and make them touch it just in case.
Hey, taste this milk. Yeah. Does this taste bad to you?
So now, and what we kind of learned from season one is that Sky was orphaned, I guess we could say, you know, as a baby or a young child, and that she is supposedly an 084.
Yes.
So does that have some sort of connection to this obelisk as well?
Oh,
because we're assuming that wasn't that far back.
I think it totally does. I mean, there are all sorts of theories about, you know, alien, you know, that she's part alien or that the obelisk, you know, grants powers or responds to people with powers. Raina's known that she is special, but like we don't understand yet what her connection to people with special abilities is, and you know, her fascination with them, because there's obviously something going on. She's very enamored by people that have abilities. You know, from Carl
and I think. It seems to me as if maybe her curiosity about that stuff is because she's trying to figure out who she is,
or
why she has these.
Yeah, I think it's more of a why she has whatever it is she thinks she has versus a where did she come from. She seems to know, and she seems to have. Of course, there's a lot of information that Raina seems to have about herself, about Sky, about this doctor character, and she seems to know a lot of stuff that's happening, but is just happy to let it happen on its own. Like, she was working with Hydra, but only because it furthered her ends. And now she has basically divorced herself from them because, you know, hey, they're just into world domination. So we get an insight into what she's looking for. She's not looking for world domination. She's looking for, what is it? Enlightenment. I think she was talking about the speech that she gave to Coulson. That is a very important defining moment, because she's spelling it all out for Coulson and for the audience. I think at that point, it's just, we don't understand where she's coming from, so her words don't penetrate and mean as much as they will, you know, in 6 or 8 or 10 episodes or whatever when we find out what's going on.
Yeah, and, you know, usually I kind of speculate what I think's going on or what it all meant. But this one, I just kind of wanted to share that a lot of other questions arose in my head as I was watching all of this unfold.
Now, I'm going to take us off in a slight tangent from this, but it has to do with the obelisk. And when she touched it, it went a different color. It was showing oranges and yellows when she touched it. And I believe when Hartley touched it, it was kind of blues, if I'm not mistaken. I might have to go back and look and see what happened, what, you know, color stuff was when Hartley touched it. But the
images appeared for both of them, right?
Not as much when Hartley touched it. I mean, there was at least that one image, the one thing that was like a circle kind of in the top middle, like I said, that would be like where you'd put your ear to. That's why I said it looked like a phone.
Uh-huh.
But when Raina touched it and she was, you know, moving it around, we saw lots of other images appearing on it that were very reminiscent of the drawings that Coulson's doing. Lots of circles and lines connecting them, you know, some squiggles and things like that. And I can't take credit for this. I saw somebody else had posted this online as something to look into. There is a current series that Marvel Comics is publishing right now called Inhuman, which is about there is a series of characters called the Inhumans, which have been around since the 60s. They were invented as part of the Fantastic Four characters. And basically it has to do, briefly, their backstory is that they were genetically modified individuals that were experimented on by the Kree who came to Earth, you know, millennia ago and experimented on these proto-humans, these, you know, early humans, and turned them into something more. Made them inhuman by giving them special powers. And then the Inhumans all go and live in there are several different places. But they make their own little enclave, either like on the moon or in Antarctica or something like that. So the current series is talking about these characters, the Inhumans, and the fact that there's these latent abilities, kind of like mutant powers, but again, it's kind of different than being a mutant, like with the X-Men. But there are these inherent powers that are in certain individuals, and they can be triggered by something called Terrigen Mist, which is a chemical that brings these powers out and brings their inhuman powers to the surface. And if you look at the logo for the comic Inhuman, in the first few letters, in the letters, are these boxes and lines and circles that are all connected that are reminiscent of the stuff that Coulson was drawing and of the images that we saw on the obelisk. I will post a picture of this logo or a piece of this logo that's blown up enough so people can see what I'm talking about on our Facebook page, which we'll give you a link to at the end of the episode here. But I'm wondering if they are, you know, if they're trying to say that that's kind of what they're doing without spelling it out, or if this is just sort of a like a red herring that just is a coincidence, and they, you know, they were like, oh look, the logo for this. Maybe we can tease people into thinking we're talking about Inhumans. But Inhumans, again, have this relationship to Kree. It's different than mutants. It's something that they could do in their series and bring characters with special powers in. So I don't know. An interesting theory, nonetheless.
That is an interesting theory.
So anything else you want to talk about with the obelisk before we move on to a couple other elements here?
No, I'm stumped on that, but I'm stumped in a good way.
Okay.
I think we'll continue to see it over a period of time, what its abilities are, what the capabilities of this thing are.
I think it's interesting that, you know, we saw it in 1945 and then it gets locked away. But there's obviously some other research on it because Coulson had information in his files. There was a picture of Peggy Carter that he was looking at and was able to bring up some other images of the obelisk and stuff like this, and asked the computer, you know, to let him know when it shows up on the grid or whatever it is. So, yeah, it's obviously going to be a plot element throughout the at least the first part of the season here. Okay, so another interesting mystery that is not as metaphysical or mystic as the obelisk is who's funding Talbot. And so he seems to, you know, get a lot of information and kind of know what's going down. And he has, as he says in this episode, there's a senator with very deep pockets that is funding him so that he can offer Hunter, you know, whatever he needs to turn Coulson in, right? You remember that in the helicopter?
Uh-huh.
So I did some... There are a number of different senators that get referenced in Marvel Comics. Senator Kelly is one of them, but he's part of the mutant X-Men universe. He's the one that enacts the Mutant Registration Act, and he was in the first X-Men film. So they're not really – I don't think they can work with that character. But there's another senator that's shown up in a number of Amazing Spider-Man comics, Senator Ward. And of course, what I find interesting about this is he—you know—he's a rich guy. He has the same last name as Agent Ward, right? So that's an interesting connection. That's, you know, maybe possible. Ward's family—I can't remember which episode it was in season one—but somebody compared his family to the Kennedys, and of course, Teddy Kennedy was a very famous senator from Massachusetts. So there's some potential to make this senator, and I don't think that's just kind of a one-off. I think we'll be finding out a little bit more about that character. I feel that there's, you know, potentially some connection there, which should, you know, should that materialize, I think that'll be really interesting in terms of the family dynamics. I'm assuming it could possibly be, you know, not like an uncle or something like that, but it could be like Ward's brother, who we found out a little bit about. They teased us a lot about his familial relations in season one, and then they kind of held out on us until like Ragtag right at the end of the season, and, you know, there's a lot more to be explored with that. So I think that is there's a lot of potential there for some storylines that could be really interesting. I didn't know if you were familiar with
completely.
This guy. So,
if that's who it is, I mean, you've got some potential redemption of Ward, and I had some great storylines there.
Definitely. So that I guess only time will tell on that one. The other thing I wanted to bring, well, I want to talk about Mac and Fitz for a minute here, because I was really impressed with their performance in this week's episode, and the way that Mac treated Fitz. He didn't know him before the accident, so he really is just taking him on face value in this current episode. And I thought that was pretty cool, because Sky and Trip and May from last week, it seems like they're all having kind of a pity party about Fitz. And Mac just is like, you know what? If I'm going to be blunt, I'm going to call it the way it is. And, you know, I'm sorry that, you know, your friend left and everything, and that you've been injured, but, you know, we have to do what we have to do. I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on what was going on with Fitz and Mac and back at Shield base here.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, I really liked the character of Mac. They just kind of threw him into the mix and made him likable almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's going to be vital to Fitz's recovery. because even after he started working with him, you saw Simmons less frequently. You know, you saw Fitz's hallucinations of Simmons less frequently.
I found it interesting, though, that the Simmons hallucination was like eyeing Mac.
Yeah.
Which is weird because, you know, obviously that's a reflection of Fitz's psyche. And so it's like, why would he have her doing that? But I don't know.
Well, he's, you know, Mac's a pretty good looking guy. I mean,
2 tickets for the gun show.
Also, I think that she kind of represented the side of Fitz that's saying, you know, you've got to get somebody's help. You need some support here, and I think it was seeing Mac as a person that could be that support.
So he'll be kind of filling in the way that Simmons, the real Simmons, and then the hallucination of Simmons have been doing for him.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And I guess maybe, you know, in a different way.
Oh, sure.
Almost the support that he needs to kind of continue to heal, if that's the path they've got for him.
Okay.
But it, it made a really good team. I like those two characters together a lot, especially the condition that Fitz is now.
Now, is Mac, is he trustworthy? Do you think he is, like you said, they made him a likable character, like, right off the bat, which kind of puts me on the defensive.
Yeah, well, given the history of that, I suppose that makes a lot of sense.
I can't trust anyone on this show.
Well, you really can't. And is he trustworthy, you know, because I am who I am? I'm going to say yes. I mean, mostly probably because I want to trust him, mm-hmm. because I like him. But I don't know what purpose it would serve him to sort of get close to Fitz. Well, no, I take that back. Because look,
there's all sorts of reasons. I mean, yeah.
He's looking through all of Fitz's you know, creations and mm-hmm. inventions, and he had access to all that
yep.
stuff.
Yep. Here's my thing.
Oh, man, what are you doing? You're making me doubt Mac.
I'm sorry, man. So here's the thing. From the beginning, and I mean by the beginning, I mean last episode, Hunter, the way they set him up was a guy to betray them. Like, he seemed to be only out for himself. And even though I knew that that's what was going to happen this episode, I mean, it seemed very telegraphed. I felt that he was the rogue with the heart of gold, you know, that he was doing things, as Coulson says, he was doing the wrong things, but for the right reason. And even though he, you know, basically completely screwed the team over, shot May. God, that's going to be beautiful when they have a confrontation. Because remember the last time somebody screwed her over, he got punched in the larynx. And his hand was, or his foot was basically stapled to the floor. I kind of saw that coming, and I'm like, they're going to, you know, basically redeem him by the end of the episode. Meanwhile, they've taken Mac, and they've made him this, this strong, intelligent, handy, handsome character, like, that you like right out of the gate. And, oh, he seems above reproach. And so I'm like, well, they're making you think that Hunter's the bad guy, but they're turning him around, and they're making you think Mac's this great guy, and he's going to be the one that, of course, everyone's going to start liking, and then he's going to turn around and screw you the same way that Ward did. Now,
okay. I never saw Hunter as the bad guy, though.
I saw him maybe
for a couple seconds.
Not as a bad, I guess. I mean, bad guy might be too strong. Not as bad guy in the same way like Ward was, but I mean, he's an opportunist, right? He's a mercenary, oh, sure. And he was always kind of just out for himself. That's what it appeared, and it's what it seemed to keep appearing. Like this episode, you know, I want my money. I also want Idaho's money and Hartley's money, and you know. Coulson's like, oh, of course, now you show your stripes. And he's like, no, you know, I want to give it to them. You know, it's everything that seemed to happen. It's like, oh, that's the obvious thing that he's saying. But then he says that he's doing it for these, you know, more nobler reasons. So, I don't know. I mean, he's a more complex character. And I really like the Hunter character because like I said, he's kind of roguish. So you never know what you're going to get, but I think it's going to go in generally a good direction. Even though he does make some silly and stupid mistakes, like leaving a high position with a sniper rifle to run down and bump into a hot dog cart before firing the bullet. That's pretty stupid.
Well, yeah, you know, what are you gonna do? But he's kind of like he reminds me of like the rogue that will, what you said, the heart of gold, but I mean like that somebody will, you can still trust because they'll always do the right thing, like a Han Solo type character.
Yeah, I even feel he's more up, like, I feel he's more opportunistic than Han Solo, in that kind of rogue. Like, I know that, like, you know, Han was really out for the money, but he really hung around a lot longer than he even ever needed to, I felt, you know, in Star Wars. Whereas Hunter, I mean, like, you know, he went and you know, he was told, you know, oh, how much money do you want to sell out? And I'm like, this is where he's going to make it sound like he's selling out, but he's not really selling out. And he's like, $2 million and I want a funeral. And it's like, okay, well, maybe he is selling out. And then he shows up back at the base and I'm like, okay, this is where he's, you know, going to pretend to have sold out and tell Coulson he didn't. And then no, he sold him out. It's like, okay. So they're going to do something good with him by the end of the episode. And I think he came around, but I don't know. They're making some complex characters here, I think. I'm never really sure what I'm going to get, but he's enjoyable at least.
Like him, yeah. Like him. I like the new addition so far.
Yeah. Yep. And I'm kind of bummed we didn't get to see Koenig in the episode. But
no Koenig in this one. He was down watching Ward, I think.
He was either that or they said he was out running errands, like he was picking up supplies or something like that. Might have been,
but ingredients, to make something on the George Foreman grill, I think,
and some new walls.
Oh yeah, he had to make a wall run.
Yeah, I had to make a wall run. One final thing, I wanted to discuss. I was thinking about this last week, and we've touched on this a little bit in some of our shows from the previous season, but I kind of wanted to ask your opinion on this, and I don't know that we're the two most qualified guys to discuss this, both being like white middle-aged guys, but is this one of the most diverse shows on television, do you think? I don't watch a lot of other, you know, there's very limited TV that I do watch, but it, to me, it seems pretty diverse in terms of the casting, different types of actors and characters, men, women, different races and things like that. Do you have any insight or thoughts about that?
Yeah, and not watching all the shows on TV and not counting reality shows, where they, right, of course, have all the token, not characters, I guess, but the token contestants, so they are multiculturally diverse. I'll say it's definitely a good one. It has some real strong women in it, different ethnicities. It hasn't played to the stereotype of having the bad guys all be different, from different cultures and stuff. Actually, as I'm thinking, the bad guys are typically the white guys, unless you count the Hydra, who are just Nazis.
Nazis
are always a good go-to bad guy, though.
Oh, I love hating Nazis on the show. That's always good. But when you look at the makeup of the team, especially this season with the addition of Mac, you've got two men of color. Really, there's only one white guy. Well, okay, I take that back. Two white guys, Fitz and Coulson. And, you know, Fitz isn't really firing.
Not counting Ward anymore?
Well, so Ward's not really on the team, though, you know, he's in there. And like you said, you know, they've kind of made him a bad guy, too, to a degree.
That's true.
Right? You know, he's betrayed them. Like you mentioned, they've got strong female characters. You've got Sky Simmons, when she's on there, a strong character. Obviously, Agent May. The women pass the Bechdel test, which is something that I read about on some different blogs, where So for those not familiar, the Bechdel test is a test that you can apply to see if the female characters are just, you know, like love interests, or are they actually a little more developed? Are they there for the men, or are they there for the fact that they are female characters? So to pass the test has three goals for it. First is it has to have at least two named women in it, meaning you can't just have, like, you know, girl in background. They have to talk to each other. So it's not just a woman interacting with a man. It's actually two women interacting with each other. And they talk about something besides a man. So, like, you think about, like, these romantic comedies and stuff like that, that, you know, where it's just got women, you know, guy talking to a girl, and the girl might talk to the girlfriend, but they're talking about the guy, you know. So it's interesting. I think that just given the makeup of the producers and the writers and things like that, you know, these are some things that they want to, you know, put out there on TV. They want to show these multicultural groups and strong women characters and, you know, have a well-rounded ensemble cast that any person could sit down and say, oh, you know, I could see myself in this role. You know, and just have lots of diversity in it. I think it's really cool. I'd be interested to know what some of our listeners think about the diversity on the show. Is it just, like, as you say, is it more of a token sort of diversity, or is this actually authentic, diversity that we're seeing on the show? I'd be interested to know.
Yeah. And I would say it's probably not as much of a token diversity, like you said, because there's not just one. You know, that it's kind of spread around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, and, you know, and...
But again, yeah, that's coming from, you know, middle-aged white guys.
Yeah. So anyway, just something that I kind of wanted to bring up, and it's something that's kind of interests me just in terms of, you know, diversity of casting and things like that, because we don't all live in a white male universe. So just... I think it can make everything a little bit more interesting, because you can get all sorts of different points of view from the actors, as well as from the characters that they portray and the way that those characters are written. So anyway, just something to think about. And I guess with that, we will leave you with that for another week's episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please, please leave us some feedback on iTunes. We love seeing that. And also let us know what you think. You can email us at shield@randomchatter.com. You can also get on our Twitter feed at Agents Podcast, or check out our Facebook page where there's all kinds of good stuff posted. Facebook.com/Agents Podcast.
And I'll make sure at that Facebook page, I'll put up the Inhumans, the portion of the Inhumans logo that I was talking about earlier, so you guys can take a look at it and see what you think. You can also check out the other podcasts that Josh and I do, Green Justice, an Arrow podcast, and Scarlet Velocity, a Flash podcast, which are both on Random Chatter. Those will be starting up the third and first season next week. And also remember that all shows are available in the iTunes Store and through Stitcher for Android or iOS. And if you enjoy the podcast, please be sure to tell all your friends about us, because that's the only way we're going to continue to grow. So for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, this is Jay.
And this is Josh.
Signing off from Level 7. This podcast is not endorsed by ABC Television or Marvel Entertainment. The official website for Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. can be found at www.agentsofshield.com. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and related elements are copyright Marvel Entertainment, LLC.
Transmission terminated.